Accession number 27791, Mr. Reuben Hyams, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Hyams?
I was born in Petticoat Lane, in the heart of London's East End, in the Jewish section mainly, of course. I'm not from Central Europe. My family.
Before we go, what was your date of birth?
Oh, the 27th of May, 1918.
And Karen, you tell him about your family background. Well, your Jewish family background.
Jewish background, not Orthodox in any way. My grandfather ran a jelly deal shop. And my ancestors arrived in this country around about the time of Cromwell, coming from Spain and Portugal via Holland and Germany. And that's both sides. So I'm what they call a Sephardi Jew. I have no, I do not speak Yiddish, I've learnt the Yiddish and things like that, but I'm completely Anglicised. Utterly.
And your family was?
Oh yeah,
your parents.
The same. It doesn't mean to say that we're not Jewish in that we're proud of our Jewish ancestry, so I am. But we're not fanatical. We don't keep very much because I'm a free thinker in any case.
And what did your father do for a living? Tell us a bit about
I'm going back to when I can remember because mine was a result of my father's second marriage. He had 8 children by his first wife who died, and then come me later on, and I'm the oldest of the 2. And at the moment, I'm the survivor of all of them, the last one. He was, for many years, a highly skilled shoemaker, till he had an accident and lost the use of his hands, and then he was out of work. Of course, that's in the 30s, and you could imagine, unless you went through it, you must have heard about it, what it's like. Well, we survived.
How did the family cope?
Well, we went down to the time when we were what was known as RO, relieving office. That was you had to work, you got unemployment money for what it was at the time. It didn't affect me personally, this was my father. And then I think I was about 9 or 10 or something like that. So. And the accident happened. I don't remember much about it, to be honest. And of course, couldn't work, got so much pay for whatever it was, I don't know. And then they got onto the relieving office, and that means means test. And that's the thing I remember very, very well.
Tell me about it, because people don't understand about the means test, though.
You see, you get the unemployment or whatever it was for so long, and you'd have to, then you could, it stopped. Then you went on to, I suppose it was charity, let's be honest, relieving office, or like it was done by the government. You'd have to apply for it, and they'd come round and they'd say, right, there's only 2 of you in the house, you don't need 4 chairs, sell them. You can't eat a piano, sell that. It was degrading in some ways, but eventually some people got money, but most of us got what BMC, bread, meat and coal tickets. You could exchange it for like basic grace food and coal, but some people sold them to gamblers, because sold them to the people for money. They were the people that sold them were the gamblers. They wanted money, cash, because they went without food. And I've never seen a rich book. I know rich bookmakers, but I've never seen a rich punter. So from then on, I have never been a gambler. Yeah, it's occasional on the derby or something like that. But otherwise, I don't.
So how many were there in the family?
Myself, there was my mother and father, and my younger brother. There were various aunts, mostly spinsters, who lived locally. And I have no idea of the background of my father exactly, except from the general what I just told you.
Now, what was your housing like?
A private flat. We had 2 bedrooms, a kitchen, a bathroom. The toilet was right next to the kitchen, to the cooker. And there was a coal bunker, and at first we had gas lights, and I can remember the day when they installed electricity. Oh, what a surprise, you know. And of course I studied the local school till it closed.
Now tell me about your education. That's in Petticoat Lane in the same area.
Yeah.
What was your education like?
Ordinary elementary school, but although it was an LCC school, it was within the boundaries of the City of London. Remember the LCC. And of course, there used 30, 40 children in the class, not normal. All our teachers were just a sir or miss. There were no first name. And discipline was strict. Some schools were stricter than others. But I think the thing we learnt, apart from our normal reading, writing and arithmetic, was respect. Respect for other people, respect for yourself, which is lacking today, I think. That's only my opinion.
Now, what were you, how did you do at school? Were there any subjects you particularly
well,
liked?
Well, I must say, I was a generally normal pupil until I had an accident, which resulted in staying away from school for about 3 months.
Now, what was the accident?
I fell in the house and busted my nose, whatever it was, and I lost a hell of a lot of blood, which resulted in me becoming anemic. And at that time, of course, the treatment was like today, I'm going back 70 odd years. Supposed to eat raw steak or nearly. Anyway, when I did go back to school, of course, I'd lost 3 months tuition. And I came at the time when I think it was March when I had the examination. And instead of going into the class where I was when I had the accident, they put me into a higher class. Of course, I was completely at sea. The results of the examinations came out. Remember, I was only young. It didn't mean anything to me at the time. And in an assembly one day, a special occasion, oh, so-and-so, you've got prize for so-and-so, so-and-so, you've got a prize for so-and-so. And then they call me, Reuben Hines. Fine. Onto the stage, onto a chair, onto a desk. This boy is going to a city school. Which that's what they called him in there. So I ran home, and my mother said, what's doing it? She was a very short woman, very calm, very kind, but she also had a bit of a temper. I told her, she said, what? It was the assistant, wasn't the headmistress, or headmaster, because there were two schools, a junior and an infant, and she was the assistant in charge of the infants. There was another one, and Mr. Daly, who finally ran away with one of the teachers. I was scared, like, remember that? I don't know, too young to understand it. And there was quite a hullabaloo in which she assaulted the teacher.
Your mother?
Yes. The outcome of it was that there were no charges made and apologies all the way around. And then I had to take lessons in the evening. And from then on, I was never less than third right the way through my school day.
Any particular subjects you were good at or bad at?
No, just generally all round rotten. No, not nothing particularly.
So you were pretty good at all of them?
I suppose it's intelligent accounting, not learning. There's a big difference. And I think I'm intelligent to some extent. And then I went on then to Lyle. My school closed down, Grover Lane, and I went to Jude Free School, which was the biggest school in the world at that time. And there I became vice captain. And I stayed there till I left school.
How old were you when you
14.
Left? So that'd be what, 1932?
That's right, 1932, 18 and 14.
Now, had you got any qualifications or any plans when you left school? Or?
The plans I had was to get a job. Because that was the time there were three men of millions of unemployed. And the job I got was in the Houses Warehouse Company, which was then where my old school had been. They pulled it down and built this company. And I stayed there till I was nearly six.
What work were you doing there?
I started off as a packer, and then I became assistant control manager. I knew where everything was stacked there. So
What was this firm? What was it doing?
It's a general wholesale, supposed to be wholesale, but all sorts of things. All different departments. I worked in the juvenile and baby linen. That's nappies, and from nappies up to blazers, for school blazers. And
so it's a wholesale tailor's.
It's supposed to be. There were wholesale sections, but you had to have a buying card to get that book. And they're probably a bit cheaper than others. They worked Sundays instead of Saturdays.
So you did that from 1932 to when?
Oh, I think till 16, for 2 years. Because then, as I was approaching 16, and there was a minimum rate of pay, bye-bye Ruby.
The section?
Yes. And there's not much you could do about it. Of course, I told the governor what I thought of him. He said, I was going to sack you if you've already done it. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I was off for about 6 weeks, I'm sorry. Then I finally got a job in Houndsditch, again, over the Christmas period.
Now, what was this house?
That was wholesale. That was a wholesale.
Another wholesale.
Yeah, yeah. But on a much smaller scale. And there I met my art school friend worked there at the same time with me. But I knew it was only going to be temporary. Anyway, after Christmas period, I was out of work for a few months, which I found very degrading, to be honest.
Well, tell me what it was like being, and that'd be about 1935, wouldn't it?
Something like that, yes, that's right, about 1934-35.
What was it like being unemployed?
Well, you had to report every day for a job. And if you sent you on a job, they gave you a card, and if you came back without their card filled in as unsuitable, you lost your pay. Anyway, eventually I got a job in a firm called Julius & Company, and I stayed there for 44 years.
Now, what was that job as?
That was in the wholesale manufacturing of ladies' clothing. And my job was, first of all, dispatched, and then I became in charge of the, it's called the trimming department, which is a much more complicated thing. There where you would get the, after the design had been decided upon, I'd work up the different sizes, and they'd give you a costing for each size. And I'd have to work out the price, because I knew the... And then they'd give me orders, and I'd have to work out, this piece is 78 yards, it will make so and so, to cover all the orders. So it was, we didn't have computers then, just be pencil and paper. And so I worked at that till I did pretty well there.
And you did that until you were called up?
Yeah, till I... Of course, the pay was increased, which is not too bad. But here, may I digress here to come back to an incident. Oh, no, we haven't come to the war yet.
No.
Well, actually I have, because I've got there for 44 years until I...
But we haven't got there. Now, what about any... Did you have any big hobbies or interests, like Boy Scouts or anything like that?
Well, this is... I was going to say this. My mother always said to me, if you join the Scouts or the JLB, which is Jewish Lads Brigade, should there be a war, you'll be the first to call up, so don't let me, she never let me go into any. And of course, I used to do odd jobs at the weekend in the lane and things like that, working people at the stall, helping the pizza stall out. I mean, if you lived in the Petticoat Lane at that time, if you really wanted to, you could always get something, if only for a couple of hours. And I never was interested in that, but my friend and I were more politically minded, because I joined the Labour Party League of Youth at 16.
Now, tell me, what had formed your politics?
Well, so living where I live, under the conditions I did live and exist at the time, I don't think there's any other reason for me not to. To me, it was a driving force. And I was pretty active.
And what sort of... That was in 1936 you joined then?
No, it was 1939. Yes, I was about 16, yeah.
16, 34 then.
So, yeah, but I was 16, yeah.
So 1934,
I joined the League of Youth,
not
Labour
Jewish.
Party. Yeah.
Now, how was the League of Youth organised? We're interested in this.
Well, it was attached to the local branches, and there was a league section, and you did exactly the same as them. I remember at one time there was a caucus to get rid of a certain councillor, and succeeded. He was a very unpleasant man. That's when I decided the point, but it did, and we took part in such in electioneering posters and things like that. Pretty much the same as they do now, to some extent. Not in the street, but the only thing we did in the street was when we used to paint up in white paint, white wash actually, with a lot of size in it. Meeting here, so and so, or vote for so and so, and here comes an incident.
Now, this painted just on walls?
On the curbs, mainly.
On the curbs?
Mainly, yeah. I was actually in Wentworth Street, which is between connecting Middlesex Street and Commercial Road, one evening after the market closed. And my friend and I were doing this vote for so-and-so. All of a sudden, a car drew alongside with four men in it. And four black shirts. And they started shouting abuse. So I didn't get out of the car. I flung the bucket of white ones up. And a few minutes later, they'd gone round to Commercial Street Police Station. There was a police station there then. And here the bells coming, you know, we had bells then. So we ran. And as I ran, I still had the brush in my hand. The bucket of whitewash had left. I was covered in it, and I flung it in my mind through somebody's shop window. So anyway, I ran up to, there was a little, I suppose, gambling den, although it was a cafe, and they had a pool table. And I stood under the bottom, the police were after me. Nobody, everybody stood around the pool table watching it. I was underneath. The police came in looking for me, I wasn't there. Anyway, that's the only brush with the law I've ever had in my life. Well, not, I'm not talking about military law, the thing entirely. And it was like that. I fought with the fascists and things like that.
Tell me about that, because Mosley and the black shirts, the marches in the
East End. First of all, I remember Mosley had tried every party, including the Labour Party, to get in. And I think he took his bottle from Mussolini, not from Hitler. And of course, anti-Semitism was a very easy mark. And they were very vicious at times. And you've heard of the famous Cable Street fight. I've got it up here somewhere. Oh, I wasn't in that because I was working for this firm at that time, and my governor locked me in because he worked on a Sunday.
Now, what actions do you remember? What clashes? Or was that the big one when you threw
that? Was the big one, but there were continual clashes, especially in Dalston and places like that. But I kept out of that.
You weren't involved in any of that?
No. There were groups that were specialised in it, but I wasn't. But anyway, by this time I was helping to run an eel stall.
The what stall?
Jelly deal stall. I suppose from when about 17, 18, my uncle started his own business.
I know you're going to think, what's the War Museum interested in this, but we do social history as well. How do you run a jelly deal store? I mean, they don't have them now, or
well,
if they have them, they
In those days, jelly deal store. First of all, my uncle worked with my grandfather, who ran the eel shop till it went bust. And then he became a coalman. People did anything in those days, to be honest. May I here digress again? I've been asked by Jewish people, how can my grandfather, who was a Jew, run an eel shop which is not kosher? So I said, he could have been a cat burglar. They said, what do you mean? I said, well, he was a highly skilled cigar maker. He used to make them by hand. And his firm went bust, and he's looking for a job. He'd saved some little money, and this shop came available.
Now, I can understand what you're saying. Where do you get the jelly deals from? Jelly deals.
You have to go down the market and you buy your eel fresh, live. Of course, now you can buy them all cooked. You take them back to wherever you want, your base, and you wash them, and you cut them, and they're boiled with the secret ingredients like allspice and stuff like that. When they're cooked, you lay them out in dishes till they're cooled off. And in those days, we didn't have refrigerators. They were just packed in ice. And that's where you get jelly deals from. Of course, you can serve them hot with mashed potatoes and stuff like that.
But on the stall, they'd be cold.
On the stall, they'd be cold. I used to sell a few prawns and cockles and milk and things like that. And one worked till I finished work where I was in the afternoon till about 7. I'd go home and meal. And I'd go down from 8 o'clock to give my uncle a chance to go back to the mill. And I'd be at that, you were allowed to serve till 12 o'clock.
Midnight,
yeah. And then, of course, you had
so
to...
So you'd be serving people coming out of the pubs, I suppose.
Oh, yes, especially the ladies of the light. Yeah, may I... Another duck there, sir. I was doing it for about a few years. I can't remember how many. And occasionally, one of these ladies would come up who hadn't done very well. Can you let me have a shilling for the meal? This is a big meal for them. I never wanted to ever get let down. Because as soon as they got a mark, they'd had a few drinks, give them a couple of bob for me and a fag of the fag. I never got let down. Whatever else they may be, they were honest with each other. Anyway, so I carried on with that. Now, where was I? I lost myself now.
Well, your main hobby seems to have been the Labour Party and working on this jelly deal. Any other hobbies? Or?
No. I didn't have time for hobbies, you see, because I had to be at work at 9 o'clock in the morning. So if it was out till 12 o'clock at night.
Now, you were a political young lad, you're in the Labour Party.
Yeah, I was political.
And you were Jewish. Which, you know.
Yeah.
Now, were you very aware of what was going on in Germany? Never mind
rumours. We heard rumours.
And now, what were the rumours coming out in the 30s from Germany?
That Hitler was violently anti-Semitic. Not Mussolini, as far as I know. He was violently anti-Semitic, and that we'd never had... Because the point is, I didn't have access to the Jewish newspapers, but not being interested in that to extent. But they're probably more in the Jewish newspapers. The English newspapers, for Jewish people, was like Jewish Chronicle and things like that. But then, of course, it gradually got worse and worse and worse. By 1938, I knew we had to go to war. I carried on working to the Ilstall till just before the war. And now I'm coming up. What else? Anyone know anything about my background? My father was still alive. My mother was still alive. My grandfather had died. And it was just as we lived in two flats next to each other in the same block of flats that I'd lived
still before. In Petticoat Lane.
Yeah. In New Goldstone Street, the name of. Not Goldstone Street, there was New Goldstone Street. Goldstone Street was where the baths were. And that's another thing. No baths. Had we managed?
Nope.
Well.
How?
Well, we either had the sink bath in front of the fire and hot water, buckets of hot water, or we went to the local baths for 2 pence and you got a towel and a piece of soap. For 3 pence, you got 2 towels. And you take your clean underwear.
These are the communal baths then?
Oh, yes. The baths are still there, they're wrecked and ruined now, but they haven't rebuilt it. But it was it was somewhat like a club, you know. Everybody met there. And of course, there was also Russian steam baths, which was mostly for the people from Central Europe. I've never been in one in my life, although they tell me it's very good, very relaxing. Russian steam baths. Of course, then school we learned swimming, but no, the usual curriculum at school.
As you're approaching the war, now what's the next thing that happens? Did you try and enlist beforehand?
Yeah, I obviously knew certain. I suppose anybody with any common sense could see that this man was never going to be satisfied. And by this time, the rumours about what was happening in Germany to Jewish people were very, very strong. Only rumours, and so I had my doctor, I had to go to my doctor in East End for something. I had a cold or a chest cold, and I told him I was thinking of enlisting.
Volunteering.
Not in the TA. They said to me, they won't take you. I said, why? Well, I understand that he was one of the doctors that used to examine them before going in. He said, you're far too myopic, short-sighted. They won't take you. So I immediately volunteered for the ARP, Air Raid Precaution, joining the first aid section.
And this is before the war?
Before the war. It was 1938, mid-38 to 39.
Who exactly were you joining? Is it Air Raid Precaution?
Air Raid Precaution. I joined the first aid section, a volunteer, part time.
And where were they based?
I can't remember exactly. They were based near the, not in the town hall. I can't remember.
Okay.
Somewhere within my area, they had what later became a warden section, I think.
So you signed up to join this, the first aid section. Now, why the first aid section?
Because I was interested in first aid.
Why? What had caused that? You know.
Well, no, just general. No, nothing. But I knew I was no good for building and rescue work like that. I couldn't drive, and I thought, well, the next best thing I can learn first aid, which I did.
Now, tell me about the first aid you were taught, because it'll be quite interesting how much knowledge you were given before the war. What were you taught?
I was taught, start first of all, the normal skeletal structure and it's basic first aid, you know, how to treat a wound, what to do with the bandages and things like that, which was no good to me when I went to the RAMC because they just all destroyed. We get all that and start from scratch.
So it was just basic?
Basic, yes. Of course, later on, as the need increased, obviously they got more and more expert or taught more.
Any other activities with them? I mean, did you actually have practice deployments or, you know, or help at sporting? You know,
no. They weren't that far advanced. But there was equipment laid on. I had a gas mask, which was later... I didn't have any anti-gas clothing or anything like that. At that time.
This is 1938-39, before the war starts.
Yes.
So anything else about your training with them? Or is
no, just general. No, nothing special.
Now, so what about the next thing would be coming up to the outbreak of war?
Well, this is a very, very strange thing. At 10 to 11 on the morning of December the 3rd, 1939, I'd gone to see a friend of mine who lived within the city boundaries. It doesn't seem a fire, I suddenly catch across the road. And of course, that Sunday morning was Pedicott Lane. And Pedicott Lane on a Sunday morning was usually crowded. I heard the announcement by Chamberlain and I went back home. On the way, I had to cross Pedicott Lane. And as I crossed Pedicott Lane, the sirens went. And I don't know where they disappeared to, but within 2 minutes, there wasn't a soul in sight. All the stalls were laying empty. I could have taken anything I wanted. All I did was go straight back to my home. And we assumed the duties that a volunteer force we'd kept concocted, which before the wardens or anything like that. We'd had a room in the basement of the flats, which we reinforced with wooden structures and seats. That was an air raid shelter, but it wasn't my doing, I was just one of the people that worked with it. And we connected first aid. And when I went in there, the people were sitting there with gas masks on, which is unnecessary. Well, of course, you know, it was a false alarm. Well, that night I slept on the pavement because we had a system of. We had an air raid warden's post just across the road, and one of us would stay there for an hour or two and come back, and somebody else would go. And if the red came up, well, we had two men from each block of flats, there were four blocks. One was started at the top, one at the bottom, knock at the doors, get them up, get people out, see, into the shelter. And that, it never worked because they never had any active raids then. At that time, well, of course,
because it was a phony war. So
that was a phony war. Yeah. We went on.
What about shelters? What shelters?
When I went, there was no real proper shelters. But up to that time, up to the actual outbreak of war was working, except the week before the governor sacked everybody.
Now tell me about that.
Well, he didn't know what was happening. A lot of people didn't know what knew that war was coming. And he put everybody on notice. So at the actual outbreak of war, I was unemployed. Although within 3 weeks, they sent telegrams to go back to work. Thank God for that. So in due course, I still did my turn at this voluntary warden thing. Nothing happened. Of course, we got more used to it. Eventually, the landlord let us have an empty shop, which we turned into... it can't be a warden, because we weren't wardens. I suppose volunteer section, we had a kettle and a pay car.
And this is sort of the first aid unit?
No, this is only volunteer. But this time I wasn't at the first aid unit. I was told I'd be called up. I wasn't called up, I'd registered.
So what were you doing now? So you weren't with the first aid unit?
No, I'm sorry. By that time, of course, I'd registered with my age group.
Now, tell me about the call-up process. What was the call-up process?
Well, first of all, I can't remember exactly when. I think it was October, November. I had to go to Whipps Cross Hospital to have my pre-med. And there I passed seven doctors and the various, you know, fill this and do that. And then came to my eyes. Now, here I thought was the barrier. I wasn't going to go in. However, they sent me to an eye specialist, and finally I came back with a report that said, right, you go in the army, but you can be B2, not A1, but you're fit for everything else, but your sight is so short-sighted, so I can't be a gunner. And did I have any any liking for any. So I told them that that was first date thing. And next thing I know, I got called up to the RAMC.